you've done this before.
Well, you know, I started out in life as a singer, so I can project or not project as you want me to.
Where do you live?
I live in Los Angeles most of the time. Sometimes I'm in Italy. I'm on my way to Italy now.
This little broadcast is supposed to be heard on KNX.
Oh,
good
station.
I understand they bury it. Like they run on the overnight or something like that.
Oh, really?
So,
no, but I hear it from time to time out there. Yeah, well, you know, we're always in our cars out there,
yeah.
So we're always...
You have heard it?
Oh, yeah.
During the day, I hope.
Yes.
Oh, they have been
yes.
running it during the day?
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty sure. I'm not, you know, like 1,000% certain, but, I mean, I knew your program, and I'd heard I had heard it.
Well, we send it out to them. It's syndicated. And,
yeah.
We have a syndication unit in Washington, D.C., so I do the reports here, and then they send them down to Washington, and then the Washington sends them out to the stations. And it doesn't have very good clearance, because a lot of stations are afraid of dealing with anything that has book in the title.
Oh, I know, especially a cow town like L.A., you know.
Well, San Francisco is not using it. And They're not, and I would think that would be perfect for San Francisco.
It is. You know, it's a very lively town, and I was up there, I was on the Owen Spann show in San Francisco, and I have people who, friends of mine who work on the Chronicle there, and, you know, it is a lively book town. You walk into a bookstore there, you're liable actually to find a book clerk who has read a book and doesn't have to refer to the computer bank to know where your book is.
And it's the home of City Lights, that famous bookstore.
As a matter of fact, I'm so happy it's still there. I go in and shop there whenever I'm in San Francisco. I go in there and make sure I buy one thing there. I want to keep those. We all have to keep the independent bookstores in business.
Absolutely. Well, I find it very hard to not buy something when I go into a bookstore.
Record stores are my downfall because also record stores and bookstores, I'm an avid opera collector. So, you know, there's a store here on 43rd and right in the ground floor of the New Yorker office building where I usually get an office at the magazine when I'm there because I'm a staff writer. And so... it's deadly. I try to go out the 44th Street exit because, you know, they have those pirate sets and they cost like $30 or $40.
You know, Michael Crichton is also an opera buff.
I didn't know that. I know him.
Do you?
Yeah, but I mean, slightly. We're acquaintances.
Oh, he tells me he has a big classical music collection, but he also goes to record shops, but he can't remember if he has a certain record. He can never remember, so what he does, he carries with him wherever he goes a little portable computer.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh,
so he'll be in a record store, and he was here, he was showing me his computer, it's about this big, he carries it wherever he goes, so he'll be in Sam Goody's or something like that, and then he'll punch it up to see if he has that particular Beethoven or whatever.
That classy. I carry a big loose-leaf notebook with everything written in it.
Do you?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I have a problem with books. Because I collect books, first editions.
Yes, I have a few.
And so I'm every weekend I go out to bookstore. I hunt bookstores, and I'll drive 2-3 hours to a book fair. But it's reached the point that I've collected more books than I've had time to remember. Because when you're young, you've read a book.
Yeah, right.
When you're younger, you read the book and you put it on your shelf and you keep it with you. You always remember it. But now that I'm older, I'm collecting more books than I've read and don't have time to read. I sometimes forget what I've had. So I've been in the position of returning books because I can't remember if I have that. So sometimes I've taken a chance and bought it, and sure enough, I've had it.
I hope you have a very large house with lots of shelves, no?
No, we have an L-shaped Manhattan apartment.
Oh, ho, ho.
My wife collects plants.
Oh, terrific. So
what happens now is... most of the books that I have, I've been putting in shopping bags and boxes, and we don't have any storage space either, so they're just sitting out. So my wife, every time I come home with a new book, and I get a lot of review copies, she says, when will this end? Most of the review copies I either sell or I give to the public library if they're... nonfiction or diet or business and things.
Yeah.
I save all the novels.
Physical fitness books.
Yeah, I don't save those.
No.
I figure one physical fitness book and one diet book is all you need. Enjoy cooking.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
I was telling Bill Adler, have you heard, you know Bill Adler? He's a literary agent.
I think he's
a book packager.
Met him years ago. Yes, right. Yes, yeah, I have.
Matter of fact, he's got a book on the charts now called Who Killed the Robbins Family.
Oh, yeah.
And he's always bringing out a cookbook. It's the I Love New York cookbook or the Miss America cookbook or something like that. And So he's bringing out a new cookbook every year, and I'm just saying, Bill, what was wrong with last year's cookbook?
Exactly.
Or diet book, I guess. What was wrong with last year's diet book?
There seems to be an endless market for this stuff.
That's right.
You know, whatever the current fad is.
Well, let's talk about your book, because I enjoyed it, and I learned a lot about racing. This broadcast, I tape it, and if you've heard it in Los Angeles, you know, it's very short, and I take elements of it and work it together as a report. That's why we can talk as informally.
Sure, we can ramble on.
That's right. And then I go through all the tapes, so the onus is on me to make it into a news report. I learned a lot about racing in Tip on a Dead Crab. In the same respect, Dick Francis comes in every year when he comes out with a book, and I had no idea that steeplechase racing in England was so much different from racing in this country. And I found out that when I talking to Francis that tracks are not laid out in the same way.
Oh, no.
They ramble all over.
They disappear behind hills and bushes and pieces of woods. And
Well, tell me a little bit, first, before I ask you some questions about the book, tell me a little bit about yourself so I have an idea of your background and how you got started in life.
Well, I'll try to keep it down to 400,000 well-chosen words. I was born here in the States. My mother is Roman-born. I was raised in Italy until I was 8 years old, and I spoke Italian and French first. And then I came back to the States in the early 30s, and then went back after the war because I wanted to be an opera singer. So the place to study opera was Italy. And I've had a heavy involvement with Italy ever since. I write from Italy quite a bit. I write two or three pieces a year for The New Yorker from Italy and occasionally for other magazines, and I've written about Italy quite a bit. And I go back every year. I try to go back twice a year. My wife and I both love it there. And I've been a staff member of The New Yorker since 1956. I started as a fiction editor there. And then in 1961, I went over to the writing side. And I've been writing for them ever since. I've written a number of books. I still keep my hand in the opera.
Are you still singing when you say keep
it? I am a lyric tenor, and I'm a bit long in the tooth now to do those juvenile parts that require heavy toupees and very kind lighting, so I don't do much public singing anymore. But I used to do a lot, quite a bit, when I lived in New York, all through the 50s and 60s, and then when I first went out to live in Los Angeles in the mid-1960s, the first thing I found myself doing was touring the San Joaquin Valley in Deflatermouse. It was fun. You know, I began to have a lot of fun with singing. Originally, the idea was that I would write to support my singing habit, and then eventually I would sing to support my writing habit, but it's worked out that I'm just a professional writer and an amateur singer. That's pretty much what it is.
Well, how did it happen that you wound up with The New Yorker?
Well, I had been contributing to various magazines in New York, and I heard from a friend of mine named Hollis Alpert that there was a job open at The New Yorker, and I went in and applied for it. And I was interviewed by Bill Shawn, the editor of the magazine, on a very hot August day in an unair-conditioned office, and I was very nervous, and I had to back out of the royal presence, much like leaving the presence of Louis XIV, because I was afraid I had disgraced myself. But he took me on. Essentially what I was a glorified reader. And I read everything that came in the fiction department, both from agents and unsolicited manuscripts, found some authors of my own, began editing some stuff, and began contributing to the magazine.
So you were the guy that kept turning me down, is that right?
Yeah, probably. People keep running into me and saying that. I used to... There were others of us who turned. But actually, I mean, The New Yorker is the only magazine I know of where everything gets at least two readings. It doesn't have to come in from a reputable agent to get a good reading. I found... In the 3.5 years I was in the fiction department there before I went over to the writing side, I found about, I think, 8 or 9 authors, some of whom turned out to be professional authors. Sometimes you get a case where a guy some writer writes one good piece, has one good piece in him, and that's it. An interesting story to tell, which has to be sort of edited into shape. The professional writers don't need that kind of help. But I got awfully tired of reading short stories. I was reading between 40 and 50 short stories a day. Not all of them good, and not all of them even readable. But 8 or 10 were readable, but mostly bad. I mean, there's not much good stuff out there. And when a good piece comes in over the transom, you feel like you've discovered a gold nugget, you know, in a riverbed. It's really nice.
What prompted you to leave New York for California?
Well, I've always liked California, and I was interested in California. And this was my first wife and I were trying to raise 3 small children in New York City. In a 2-bedroom apartment. We couldn't afford it. My first wife didn't want to live in Europe. We had tried going back to Italy in 1962. She didn't like Europe very much, didn't like Italy. It was difficult for an American woman to live in a Latin country in the early 1960s. If you're used to your freedom, it's better now, but it was still fairly restrictive. I made the rounds of the magazines, and I discovered that you know, New York was undergoing one of its periodic rediscoveries of California. About every 10 years, New York magazine editors think, hey, there's another civilization out there. Something terrific is going on. And at the time I went out there, there were very few New York writers with magazine credentials on the scene. There were a lot of screenwriters and would-be screenwriters, but there were no magazine writers. Joan Didion and her husband, John Gregory Dunn, had not yet moved back to California from the East. Brian Moore had not yet arrived on the scene. I found plenty to write about, and there was very little competition for the New York magazine market. And the original idea was to go out there just for a year, and then which we did, and then we came back and bought a house in Princeton, where we had figured out we'd like to live, and we hated Princeton. After the free and easy life of California, my children were miserable. They loved California. And we moved back to California permanently in 1966, and we like California. We miss New York, but we like California.
Now, you are currently a staff writer for The New Yorker.
Yes, I am.
How does it work out being in California, being a staffer?
Well, I'm in California about, let's say, 8 months out of the year. The other 4, I'm usually traveling and usually in Italy. And so I do anywhere between 2, 3, 4 pieces a year for the magazine from Italy. And I do some other magazine work. Not much. I'm doing less magazine work now than I used to. I'm doing more in the way of books. I've written a handful of novels, and occasionally I try my hand at, or I get some kind of a screenwriting assignment, but I don't pursue it very much. It works out fine.
You know? As a staff writer, what does that mean exactly? Is that actually a staff employee?
Well, it's a peculiar thing. I'm not on salary. If I don't write, I don't get paid. But if I get an assignment, it's a firm assignment, and I'm paid for what I do. It happens occasionally that you work very hard on a piece, and for one reason or another, it doesn't work out. But if you're a staff writer, the magazine very generously pays you, which I think is only right, after all. You know, magazines are still pretty much paying what they were paying in the 1950s. And they still have this peculiar thing of what's called the kill fee. You might spend 2 months working on a piece for which you're going to be paid $4,000 or $5,000. Then for some reason they don't like it or it doesn't work out and they want to pay you 20% of the, you know, that's the standard kill fee is 20%. And nobody can afford to work for that anymore. If you're a young writer and you need the credits and you're willing to take the chance, that's fine. But I can't work for that kind of arrangement anymore. A friend of mine once said that if Ronald Reagan were really serious about cutting the defense budget, he'd have put a magazine publisher in charge of the Pentagon. The New Yorker is the only magazine that's really generous with its writers, and it's the only, you know, the trouble with The New Yorker is it has no competition. That's my basic argument with it. It'd be nice if there were other magazines that good.
Yeah, those days of magazines like that seem to be gone. New Yorker is really a unique publication today. Tell me about your first novel. Your first novel.
My first novel was called The Fugitive Romans. I wrote it in 19... My goodness, let me think now. Must be 1953 or 4. I was just back from Italy where I had been living and pursuing my singing career. And it was a movie... It was a novel set in Rome about some Americans working in a big movie production over there. And the movie was called, in my book, Ave Caesar, but it was modeled on Quo Vadis, which was that big, I think it was an MGM film was shooting there at the time. I had a lot of friends who worked in it. I knew most of the expatriate American and English colony then living in Rome. We all of us worked in Italian movies or American movies abroad at one time or another. And so that kind of started me off writing novels.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first one.
So what is your scorecard to read in terms of books now? I think you told me a moment ago.
You know, I haven't stopped to add it all up. There must be, I think, 9 or 10 novels. The
you only list
Well,
two.
Viking only lists two,
the ones
inside,
they publish?
Yeah. No. Actually, you see, this book was originally under contract to Dodd Mead.
Yes, I wanted
remember
to get
that,
to that. Yes,
that is
something I wanted to talk with you separately about.
Yeah. Well, that's the reason, because the Dodd Mead has a policy of only listing books by its authors that they have published. Those
These are their plates.
That's right. Those are the two books that were published by Dodd Mead.
I see.
And that's why you only see two books listed there.
I see. Okay. I want to ask you about the Dodd Mead affair, because I think that's very important. And I did do a story a while back on the lust-free romances that their branch, what is Thomas Nelson, I think that's their
yes.
biblical branch, is coming
yes.
out with.
Well, that's the owners.
Oh, yeah, that's right, that's the owners. They're coming out with a line called Cherish Romances, which will have no sex, a romance novel without sex.
Well, I'm sure they will be spectacular for their dullness.
Well, tell me about you and the racetracks.
Well, I've had a long involvement with racehorses. What happened was, when I was 16, I had this beautiful older cousin who was married to a horse degenerate, a very nice man from Virginia, now dead, named Harry Woodard. And Harry loved racing. That's all he cared about. But he was a degenerate gambler. That's really what Harry liked to do. And he followed the tracks. He was at... He was in Louisville for the Derby. He was at Hialeah for the Flamingo. He was at in New York for the Belmont Stakes. He was at Santa Anita for the winter season. He just followed the ponies. And while he was losing money hand over fist at the track, Isolde was spending the rest of his money moving like a Mongol horde through department stores. And I was at my father's house in New York when I met Harry. Harry knew a lot about baseball. He knew a lot about boxing, all these things that interested me a lot when I was 16. And he happened to mention casually that he was going out to Aqueduct Racetrack the next day, and did I want to come along? Well, sure, I said. Well, my father took a very dim view of this, but then he thought better of it. He thought, well, the kid will learn a valuable lesson. Harry, he'll watch Harry lose a bunch of money, and it will be a fine, upstanding moral lesson for me. So out we went to the track. Harry, who had been so affable and loquacious the night before, turned sullen and very quiet and spent all of his time buried in a paper that looked to me like the Rosetta Stone, which turned out to be the Morning Telegraph, the East Coast racing form. And we went out to the track, and Harry proceeded to pick winner after winner after winner. We finally got to a race that Harry couldn't pick and said, "Here, kid, you pick it." It was a race for two-year-old maiden fillies. I picked a name. I'll never forget the name of this filly. Her name was Quejota. First time starter, Harry gave me $5. I bet on her. He put $100 on her. She came in at 19-1. Anyway, we went into town. Harry made about $14,000 that day. I made about $400. That was an enormous amount of money to a 16-year-old kid in 1942. So we went and had dinner at 21. We scalped tickets for a Broadway show. I came rolling into my father's apartment about 2 o'clock in the morning. Dad was sitting up in bed reading Thucydides, the Peloponnesian War in the original Attic Greek. And as I went past his door, he said, "Well, how'd you do?" expecting to hear this catalog of disaster. And I said, "Oh, Harry won 14 G's and I won 4 big C notes." And I said, "I don't see why we don't do this all the time." Well, my father not only didn't talk to me the rest of the weekend, but he never talked to Harry again, as far as I know. But anyway, it hooked me on the sport. Not the gambling aspect of it, although that's certainly an important part of it. But I fell in love with horse racing, and I have been going to the races ever since. I am currently the part owner of 2 horses. I have dabbled in it before, and there were times when I thought I would make the track my life. I'm very interested in locked-in worlds, people who have their own language, their own code of ethics, and live entirely within their own world. The theater is like that, the opera house is like that, and the racetrack is like that. And it's a wonderful, wonderful place. It's an exciting, interesting, bizarre, funny, tragic place in which there are 1,000 stories to tell. I think it was Red Smith, the famous sports writer, who said that whenever he didn't have a column, he didn't know what to write for his daily column, all he had to do was go into the stable area of any racetrack and he would have 100 stories within 2 hours. And that's one of its fascinations.
Well, your characters, predominantly Jay and... can't remember the other one.
Shifty.
Shifty and... Well, not Shifty, he's the magician, but a friend.
Jay Fox.
Jay and what was the other?
Sam.
Sam.
Sour Sam Vespucci.
Sour Sam. But they had the right feel to them, and so I would assume that since you hang at the track, that you know the people, and these are the types of people that you do see on a regular basis there, going back day after day.
Yeah, Jay Fox is modeled very closely on a very dear friend of mine who is a professional handicapper. He lives at the track. He lives by what he does there. And he's very much like a stockbroker. I mean, he's a very serious investor at the track. He does invest money for people. And he's not a gambler in the accepted sense. He doesn't gamble on other things. He's not interested in that. Horse racing is what he's interested in. And... I think in my book there is a scene in which my character Sam gets into an argument with some guy who says wants to do all kinds of things like bet exactas, bet every race, bet wildly, bet crazily, and Sam keeps saying, well, I don't do that. And the guy says, well, we're all gamblers together, and Sam says, no, you're a gambler, I'm a horse player. And that's the distinction that I try to make between guys like Jay and Sam and the average horse degenerate who would be betting on beetles if he weren't betting on horses.
I don't think it would be giving anything away if you were to divulge what a dead crab is, because you do that fairly early on in the book. Can you do that?
Sure, I can do that. That's based on a true story also. A few years ago, a couple of friends of mine had it with horse racing, and they decided they needed to get away from the ponies for a while. So they got themselves booked on a safari to Africa. And for 2 weeks they toured the game preserves and they saw a lot of beautiful animals, most of them running. They got very depressed with the fact, after about a week or so, that there weren't any saddles on these animals and there weren't any little numbers on them and there weren't any riders and they couldn't get a bet down. So by the end of this tour they were ready to get back to Hollywood Park, and they were in a hotel in Mombasa in Kenya. And they heard this commotion in the courtyard, and they went out on their balcony that looked down over the courtyard, and they were just in time for the weekend crab races. Now, in a crab race, it is a circular pit. There's a little declivity at the center of the pit, and the little crabs have little numbers painted on their backs, and they're all put in this little hole in the middle, and a net is put over them, and then people bet on them. And the winner of a crab race is the first crab that reaches any part of the outer rim of the circle. And a crab's instinct is to scuttle the hell out of there. And so then there are variations. There are obstacle races. They put down beer bottles and rocks. And you may be 2 lengths in front and your crab scuttles under a rock, feels safe, and stops. And everybody sweeps past. But anyway, these guys were losing bets. And they had no form. They had nothing. But they got down to the last race, and there was an exotic wager you could make. The last crab out of the box paid 4-1, if you could guess who the last crab out was going to be. So they're studying these crabs through their binoculars, and the waiter comes along with their second gin tonic and says, I think the 7 is dead. So they glued their Zeiss binoculars onto these crabs, and sure enough, the 7 did not move so much as an antenna. So they bet $20 on this number 7, and that was a huge bet. So immediately the people taking the money cut off the action and got the race off. And sure enough, the 7 was dead, so they cashed a big ticket. So ever since then, what I used to call a mortal lock, which is a horse that can't lose, is now a dead crab in my book.
That's a wonderful story. We're just about out of time, but I think it's important to talk about Dodd Mead and what they tried to do, because they made a rather sensational announcement in the publishing world that they were going to clean up their act and there was not going to be any more filth in their books. You'd already sent in your manuscript, they had accepted it. What happened exactly?
Well, I got a phone call last August from my editor, who is a very civilized, nice older man who had been at Dodd Mead for years. Dodd Mead, the publishing house, as you know, was bought by a religious publisher, Thomas Nelson. I believe their headquarters is in Nashville, Tennessee. And they had promised not to meddle with the trade house. suddenly I was told that there were 20 unacceptable words in my book. I was astonished because there is no filth in my book. There is no there are no explicit sexual scenes. There's very little profanity. In fact, it's one of the cleanest books I've ever written. And I was astonished. They asked me to change 20 words. Most of them had to do with the use of the word God. You couldn't use God as an expletive. You couldn't say my God or oh my God or... And I said, well, you know, when a man loses a photo finish, he's not liable. He's not going to say, oh, gee whiz, or Katie bar the door. He's going to say something a little bit stronger than that. Well, I really could have changed those 20 words without having it having made too much difference in the manuscript. But there was a principle involved here, which is that I had a contract with my publisher. I believe in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. I don't think anybody should censor anybody. And I was forced to tell my publisher no, that I was not going to change any words because these words were unacceptable to some people in Nashville, Tennessee. And it was a cynical decision on their part, in my opinion, because basically it was a business decision. These people were coming out with a new Bible, and they didn't want their competitors to spread the word out there to the moral majority that they had a subsidiary in New York that was publishing filthy, subversive books. And I was one of three authors who was dropped from the list. And I luckily found another publisher right away. So did the other novelist.
Had they paid you anything at
yes,
this point?
Yes, they had paid me in advance. And the lure that they offered was that we could keep the advance if we would sign papers releasing them from any, you know, from in other words, that we would promise not to sue them. They were in violation of their contract. And, of course, I wanted my book published. The alternative was to say no and then engage in a lawsuit, which might have dragged on for 5 or 6 years. I understand that one of the three writers involved in this is suing. He was unable or unwilling to find another publisher, and he is suing Dodd Mead. So the thing is sub judice, as they say. But it's going to drag on for years.
You mean they allowed you to keep your advance
and
yes, still market the book elsewhere?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. That was their lure. I I accepted. I wanted my book published. I fortunately found another publisher immediately. I did not accept until I was sure that I had another publisher. So they did at least, they didn't pretend that to try and get their advance back. That would have been ridiculous. I mean, they were in complete violation of the contract. If I sign a contract with a publisher and I fail to deliver a book, I'm expected to repay that advance because I have violated my contract. If a publisher violates his contract, he has to forfeit his advance. And essentially, I feel that I got the short end of the stick anyway. I was very happy at Dodd Mead. I liked my editor there very much. They had done a very nice job with my previous book, which was a book of reportage about Italy. This book had been chosen by the American Library Association as one of its notable books of the year. And I thought it was ridiculous and humiliating. And furthermore, the editor-in-chief of Dodd Mead, Mr. Lewis Gillinson, from whom I never heard directly or indirectly, proceeded to go on right on giving interviews in which he implied that it was Dodd Mead's right not to publish trash. Well, I deeply resent the implication that I am a writer of trash, and I was forced to put Mr. Gillinson on notice that he had better cease and desist because the agreement that I signed with him did not specify that he could go on giving interviews to Publishers Weekly and other newspapers, implying that we were purveyors of trash. And I'm very angry about the Dodd Mead decision, and I think it's a very ominous decision for publishing in general.
Well, I think it's an aberration. I don't know that you're talking about a Bible publishing house taking over a once prestigious publishing house.
And, yeah.
That's something so unusual. As I read the book, I had forgotten about as I the Dodd Mead affair as I read the book, and then I began to think afterward, what were these words? And I began flipping through it and I began looking for it because it is really a clean book by almost any standard today. I mean, there may be a couple of Maybe there are there any F-U-C-K's? Or?
I don't even remember.
I can't remember. I can't. I'm so used to hearing them anyway. I mean, this sort of language that I could see this book easily on a high school bookshelf.
Well, the book list, which is the American Library Association publication, as you know, chastised Dodd-Mead for having done this to my book, and so I think they referred to, they gave my book a very good review and said, how could Dodd-Mead have not published this harmless romp of a book, was the essence of what they said. And that's what I intended to write with this book. It's the first mystery I've written. I think of it as an entertainment. I had a very good time writing it. I'm probably going to write a few more with my same narrator, as long as I don't run out of ideas and I don't try to force it. And I was astonished and angered by what happened to me. It's odd because there are some other books of mine now that I would like to, two or three of them, I would like to have back, and certain scenes I would like to rewrite that I'm not happy with.
Well, in the long run, it worked out all right for him. His Viking is a prestigious publishing house, the publishing house of Steinbeck, and it's a beautiful cover. I mean,
isn't it a good cover? Yeah, yes, they've done a wonderful job.
Viking always has a nice job of printing. It's a fairly nice job of printing. Could be better, I guess, looking at it.
It would be nice if they still sewed books, don't you think? You're a collector of first editions.
Yeah, it'd be better to have it all cloth, but
yes.
they hardly ever do that. But then, by that standard, it could have been all boards, too.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
So they did all right. Plus, you were able to keep your Dodd-Mead advance, and in terms of publicity, you got mileage out of it that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
We just have to put it behind us. But one of the things that's very important to an author is the relationship, as you know, that he develops with an editor. And the man who was my editor at Dodd-Mead is a wonderful man with whom I had a very happy experience, and I thought I'd found a home. And I wish him well, and I know it's not his fault, and he's a decent, civilized man and a fine editor, and you don't like to lose people like that. That was my main distress.
Well, William Murray, my last question to you, are you a close-up magician, too?
No. I wish I were. I'm fascinated by it, though. I did a couple of stories about magic, and I got to know quite a few magicians, and there are two kinds of magic, you know, and I think the big illusions, the kind of things that Doug Henning does, are wonderful in their way, but basically it's all done with mirrors and platforms and stuff, and it's showbiz. But the people who can do anything with cards or do anything with coins or make little bits of paper disappear, that's true magic, and it takes real skill to do that.
Well, Bill Murray is certainly a worldly, interesting guy with so many irons in the fire and such an interesting background, and it's a lot of fun talking to you.
Well, it's fun talking to you.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And I hope KNX will use it when it gets out there. It'll be at There's about a three-week gap. It airs on syndication about a week after it airs in New York.
Oh, that's great.
So it'll be about three weeks before it gets out to...
Well, that's wonderful.
But everything's about a week late in California.
Well, that's fine because it's breaking, California thinks of itself as way in front, you know.
Well, they are in a lot of things.
Yeah, but not in the book business. They're way behind.
No, I guess you're right.
Sure, because the stuff, the books get to the stores later there, and... Hunter's just got my book. You know, it's a very important chain in California, and they just got my book 3 days ago.
Oh. Well, you had a very nice review in the Sunday New York Times Book Review.
The reviews have been incredible. Yeah, the Washington Post was simply...
You gave you a big spread in the New York Times Book Review, too.
Very good.
It's hard to get.
And the Post, I got a huge spread in. And
Washington Post?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The Sunday, there's a big review coming out in the Chronicle, very good review, and... the only review that was mediocre was the L.A. Times, which was a one-paragraph, and the reviewer read it strictly as a whodunit, and he figured out what the gimmick was in the middle of the book, and that's all he wrote about. He said, unfortunately, I figured this out, but he didn't say anything about anything else. But that was the only even mediocre review. Everything else has been astonishingly good, so I'm very pleased with it.
This was a good experience for you, the whole thing. Even Don Mead, in some respects, I mean, never just the editing. I know that was disappointing to the editor, but...
Yeah. You did get to keep the advance.
And you kept the advance?
Yeah.
Did Viking give you an advance, too? Or?
Yeah, but it was very small, and I took a small advance. I didn't, you know, I had 14 publishers lined up for this book to look at it, and I could have gone out and had an auction and done all that. I didn't want that. I wanted a good publisher, and I wanted the book out in the spring. Originally, it was supposed to come out in late February.
Viking's better than Dodd-Mead, anyway.
Yeah.
Better, that's a better house.
Oh, yeah.
They do a better job of
publicity. And my editor there is a loves horse racing. She's a wonderful... Do you know her, Amanda Vale?
No, I don't.
Well, she's married to Tom Stewart, the editor-in-chief at Athenaeum. And the two of them every summer take a house at Saratoga.
Mm-hmm.
That's their vacation. They go up there and they go racing every single day.
Well, I do this broadcast 5 days a week, and I work with scores of publishers, and Don Mead is just not one of them. I mean, they don't send me books. Their publicity people have never contacted me.
Really?
And I have contacted Don Mead occasionally to ask for books, and sometimes they don't come.
No kidding. Yeah, when my Italian book came out, you know, I should have been talking to you. That was 1982. You were doing this show then.
Yeah, but I never saw it. And I look for books. I go through Publishers Weekly, and I also go through they send me the book catalogs in spring and fall.
Yeah.
I also go through there to see if I like them. But these these Kirkus reviews and the Publishers Weekly reviews are good because they get
They get the galleys,
and they have a little. Even if I can look between the lines. Sometimes they don't get a good review. The books don't get a good review. Sometimes they do, but I can tell a little more about the book.
Yeah.
Whether it's the kind of thing that would fit into my broadcast, and there's plenty of lead time, like 2-3 months, often frequently.
Yeah.
So that helps.
Well, you would have liked the Italian book, I'm sure.
Sure,
it would have interested you, and you know, it was a very highly personal book. It had a lot of autobiographical material in it, plus a lot of things I've done for the New Yorker over the years.
Doubleday is bad.
Are they? Well, they're too big.
They have a new publicist there now, director, and she's trying to clean it up, and she had called me a couple times to... See, I would call Doubleday, and I would say, I'd be interested in such and such a book, if you could send it over, because I think that might be something I could use in my show. And then the response would be, why? What? I said, well, I'm a book critic, you know, I'm one of the few in the business. And,
exactly.
Yeah, but what would you do with it? I mean, maybe they had never heard the broadcast. I mean, this happened a lot. I mean, this is just not one instance. And so, finally, they would say, all right, I'll take care of it. Book would never come. You know, I might call back and say, did you send that book out? A couple of weeks later, by this time, I would have forgotten about it and gone on to other things. So, with Doubleday books... Matter of fact, I went to a guy who went to my alma mater, or taught at my alma mater, Walter Tevis. He wrote the Hustler.
Oh, sure.
He'll be out in the fall with a sequel to it, 23 years later.
Mm.
And so I happen to know Walter through alumni activities and this sort of thing. And it was Walter, he sent a copy of his own book over to me, and he and I arranged for the interview. I called Doubleday to ask for Walter's book. That book never came, and so Walter had to send a copy. Charlotte Chandler wrote Hello, I Must Be Going, a story of Groucho Marx. She's out with a new one from Doubleday. Matter of fact, I was cutting her interview today, and she sent me a copy of the book. And
it didn't come from Doubleday?
Well, and she sent me a copy, but subsequently it did come.
Yeah.
Because I had called Doubleday, and then I have this new person.
Those
there.
Are the kind of things that drive authors nuts, you see.
There was another person who called. She had done a novel, and she had hired a publicist.
Yeah.
Independent publicist, and I didn't have interest in the novel. You have to like it. You have to want to do it yourself.
Of course.
And I just couldn't get into it. But she had hired a publicist to do this, and a publicist who sent me a press kit and called almost every week. And I'm almost sorry I had to turn the book down because it just didn't fit my format very well. But it's a shame because she had to spend the money herself.
Yeah.
Because she couldn't trust Doubleday to do it.
Yeah. Some authors have to do that. As fact, it has been suggested to me, but with Viking I haven't had to do it. But who can afford it? You know, advances are not all that big, and I still have two children in college. You can't...
a series with a young writer, an advertising man who wrote a first novel. You wouldn't have heard of him, but his name is Mike Slosberg, and I decided I would take... I would follow the process of writing a novel from its inception to the writing, to the editing, to the actual printing, to its distribution, to the reviews, to the remainder desk. And so I did this with Mike, and I had to go... Publishing is incredible because they pay so poorly that almost everybody... This happened over about a 3 or 4 year period. So everybody who worked with Mike at the early days had gone, and I had to track them down to other publishing houses. Because it's very cannibalistic.
Oh, I know.
So
No.
I had to track all these people down, and Schlossberg, by this time, had wound up at the Dial Press, and he wound up putting $10,000 of his own money to publicize it because he didn't feel Dial was doing it. He hired a publicist and set out at his own expense to do some nationwide interviews, which he tried to couple with his advertising job. He tried to get the agency that I think he was a high official up to send him to Chicago so he could do some agency work there but also promote the book in San Francisco and this sort of thing. And he was seriously considering suing Dial to try to recover the $10,000 because he felt that Dial just left him in the lurch, but he never did.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see, but now, I mean, it's true, you sort of have to do it yourself, but, I mean, Viking has been very good. But I would think, I have a friend of mine whose novel is now out, Josh Greenfeld. Has he been on your show?
No, he hasn't.
Well, this novel he has out is, I'm sure, based on his time with Paul Mazursky. You know, he worked for Paul Mazursky. He worked with him on a number of his movies. I think the last one was the one he did about Greenwich Village. And I haven't read Josh's book, but Josh is a good writer and a funny writer. And Doubleday published his book, but I haven't seen an ad. I haven't heard word one about this book. You know, I've read a couple of reviews, but, I mean, they are doing zilch in the promotion area, so you haven't even heard of it.
When a publisher wants
to. Here's Mazursky with a new movie out.
Yeah.
That's a big success, Moscow and the Hudson. And you would think that some bright person in a publicity department would say to someone like you, here's a novel, which we think is, you know, another Hollywood novel, but and Josh is very articulate, very good talker, has had a wide and varied experience in the book business. He was I think he was the chief reviewer for Time for a number of years. I've known Josh a long time. And he knows where a lot of bodies are buried, and he's an excellent talker. He'd be perfect, you know.
Well, I try to seek him out, but it's not always. There are too many books that come out, but I do try to look to see if books that would interest me, but it would help if a publicity department were to let me know about it, and I'd have a better chance of getting some promotion on it. But if a publisher wants to get behind a book, they will. See, the publishing house for this book called Knopp's Trials by Donald McCaig, they're doing tremendous promotion and advertising on this book.
See, they must have a big first printing. They must have printed, what, 25,000?
Yeah, I think it was. And they had McCaig in. They sent a press kit. Not just this, but I mean a press kit that you opened up, and there were glossy photos and all of that in there. They called me God knows how many times, and I think it's Crown. And McCaig came in, and it's a nice little book. It's a heartwarming book, and it's about a dog that's stolen. It's the kind of thing that your former publisher would have liked.
Sure.
I don't think there are...
Dogs can't curse.
That's right. But they speak, in his book, they speak in Old English.
Oh, they do?
That's right. They use these and thous.
That's funny.
Dogs speak.
Yeah.
Because his belief is that dogs do speak in body language, and he tried to translate this into words. So all of the dogs who communicate to each other use this language. I thought it was criticized by a couple of the reviewers, but I thought it was a nice touch.
Yeah.
It was unusual.
Yeah, well, that's
and
one
I think
way
that
to have
confounded
it.
A couple of these reviewers.
How is the book doing? Do you know?
Well, I noticed there was an ad. I believe there was an ad this morning in the New York Times, and they've been doing it, putting ads in every week in the New York Times.
Yeah.
It's not cheap.
They've got books out there, so yeah. You see, when you have a much smaller first printing, as in my case, I haven't had an ad yet, for instance. We've had incredible review, but I think they're just quietly waiting and storing up reviews, and then they wait to see if the book is moving. then if the book moves, they suddenly they'll take out an ad.
Well, James Purdy publishes with Viking, and I know Purdy pretty well, and he's not happy with them. He says he's out with a new book called On Glory's Course.
Uh-huh.
Came out about a month and a half ago, and he complained. I was invited to a pub party for him, and it turned out, I thought it was a Viking financed publication party because a couple of Viking people were there, but when I got down there, it was in an artist studio down in near Gramercy Park, and it turned out that Purdy and this artist, who's a friend of his, financed the party themselves, and Purdy complained. He had asked Viking if they could just do the mailing, if they could just mail out the invitations, and they refused. They said, no, pub parties don't sell books, which is true, but it's something that you do for a writer if you can afford it. But there's a feeling that Purdy is Purdy's books don't sell very well, that he reaches a cultish type of audience, and they didn't want to invest too much in it.
Yeah.
They wanted him for prestige, because he's a prestige
author,
but they don't want to have to invest much money in it.
It's a terrible bind, you know, and it's very hard to break out. And the more you get locked into the big chain bookstores, and the fewer independent bookstores there are, the more difficult it's going to be to break out. Because the chains are not interested in flogging the so-called mid-list book. They're interested in flogging the bestsellers.